When I worked for HMRC, they used to regularly send us on training courses. And when we returned, we had to fill in an evaluation form to say what we'd learned. But it didn't end there, because a month later we were sent another evaluation form and we had to say what we'd learned. And it didn't even end there, because 3 months later they sent us a third evaluation form and asked us what we'd learned. This might seem like a pointless exercise, but I actually found it quite intriguing, because having returned from the training course, I used to often sit at my desk and wonder what on earth that was all about, wondered if I'd learnt anything at all. A month later, it became absolutely obvious that clearly I'd learnt something at this training course. But 3 months later, I realized just how much I'd learned and just how useful it was in doing what I did. And so 2 Sundays on, looking back at the Easter story, looking back at the time of the crucifixion and the resurrection, I wonder what we've learned about God. Personally, if there's one thing I think that emerges from the gospel writers' accounts of the resurrection, it is the contrast between the comprehensive victory of Jesus and the complete failure of the disciples. And the complete failure of the disciples is not found at the betrayal at the Last Supper. It's not even found at the desertion of Jesus when the soldiers arrive in Gethsemane. It's not even found in the courtyard of the temple when Jesus 3 times denies the fact that he knows Jesus and has any association with Jesus. The complete failure of the disciples is found here, after the resurrection. After Jesus, who has risen from the dead, has come to the disciples on 2 occasions and has shown them that he is alive. He has convinced them that he is risen from the dead. And that makes this failure absolutely complete when Peter says, "I'm going fishing." And Thomas, Nathanael, James, John, and 2 others, who we don't know their names, decide to go with him. If there's a place of complete failure, it's not before the resurrection. It's when 7 out of the 11 of the original disciples chosen by Jesus to be his closest disciples decide to go fishing. 7 of the 11 who had responded to Jesus' invitation, "Come, follow me," had accepted the invitation to share their lives with him and to learn from him, go back to what they had done before as if nothing had happened. If ever there was a sign of complete failure, this is it. If you were here on Maundy Thursday, you would have heard me speak about the completeness of failure. And you would have heard me say how the number 3, and when 3 is repeated or 3 things are done, is a sign of the completeness, of an utterness. 3 is a complete number in the Bible. But I would have told you also that it is not as complete as 7 is. You would have heard me say that whilst 3 is significant, 7 is more so. And so I don't think it's any surprise that when John records the disciples that decide to go fishing, he lists 5 by name. Peter, Thomas, called Didymus, Nathanael, the 2 sons of Zebedee, we know them as James and John. And then he adds 2 more, 2 unnamed disciples, to make 7 in all. 7 of them return to what at least Peter, James, and John, the sons of Zebedee, knew well. And in making the point that it was 7 of the remaining disciples, I believe John is underlying something that we saw in Luke's account of the Last Supper, and that is the completeness of the disciples' failure. After all, they are experiencing, they are acting as if the experiences of Jesus' death and resurrection, of all that time they spent with him leading up to the crucifixion, has meant nothing. They are acting as if the fact that Jesus is alive has not changed a single thing. And so they head off fishing. Leaves me wondering if anything has really changed. Following the constraints of the pandemic, as we gradually get used to being a community of faith again, I wonder what has changed. Of course, you might argue, and quite rightly so, that quite a bit has changed. For starters, we're a much smaller congregation. And we're beginning to have to feel what that, learn what that feels like. And of course, as being a much smaller congregation in person, we have a wonderful group of people joining us online. And that's new. And that's a new innovation, which is good news. It's good news for those of you who, for various reasons, can't make it into church and for various reasons are able to join us online. And so it's an absolute delight every time I stand up here to wave to you and say, or to ask you to wave to me and say, can you hear me? Of course, that's changed. But has anything changed fundamentally? As we begin to realize that we're not the church we once were when we entered the pandemic, have our expectations of how we function changed? I wonder if we're still trying to be a big church in small clothes. But there's much more than failure in this last chapter of John's Gospel. There's a degree of deja vu here as well, a sense of we've been here before. And this deja vu is a call to remember. This is, after all, not the first time the disciples have been fishing at night and have caught nothing. This is not the first time that they return to the shore empty-handed, and who should stand on the sea edge and call out to them but Jesus? And Jesus says, cast your nets on the other side, and then they do as they're told, and they have a huge catch of fish. Luke tells a similar story in Luke 5, 1 to 11. This is not the first time Jesus has fed people by the Sea of Tiberias, Sea of Galilee, Lake of Galilee that it's sometimes referred to, and has fed them bread and fish. In John 6, 1, we find the beginning of the story of the feeding of the multitude. Other gospel writers speak about the feeding of the 10,000. It's a feeding of the multitude with a few loaves of bread and a few fish. Here, Jesus produces a multitude of fish. There's something significant here. Something in the closing chapters of John's Gospel, by illustrating the total failure of the disciples, he then calls to mind two stories that have a deep and a long-lasting imprint on the disciples and their ministry. In drawing the Gospel to an end, Jesus calls to mind two events: an abundant provision after a barren night's work, and the sharing of food. It's not surprising that John calls to mind an abundance catch of fish, because at least three of these disciples who've gone back to doing what they used to do had responded to Jesus' call that said, come, follow me, and I will make you fishers of men, fishers of people. I will make you able to draw people to me. And so while we are not told the reason why Peter suggests they go out to fish that night, we're not We're not sure whether it's for food, whether it's to generate income, or whether it was just simply they wanted something to do, and food and income would be a byproduct of just passing the time. The fact that they catch nothing is really significant. It's a stark reminder of two things. First is that once you accept the invitation to follow Jesus, to go back to the life that you once had before is to go back to nothing, an emptiness. You might be able to do what you did before, but there's an emptiness there, a hollowness there. And so when they return to their old trade, they find their skills are still there, but they catch nothing. I've heard it said that when you move away from a place that you have lived for a while, long enough to get to know it well, when you return, you find all the things you liked about the place are no longer there, and all the things that you struggled with the place are still there. When Peter and his friends return to fishing, they catch nothing. But there's something else in the catching nothing as well, because if we remember that following the new life Jesus calls us into, that life is not dependent on our skills and abilities. It's dependent on him. In John 15:5, John records that Jesus telling the disciples, without him, they can do nothing. And so perhaps we shouldn't be surprised when the disciples get in a boat and go out to fish and they catch nothing. They will only be fruitful if they remain in him. It leaves me wondering how often we set out on a venture that we think is a good idea when in fact it only draws us away from the purposes of the Lord. In effect, it is a fruitless exercise. Here in this closing chapter of John's Gospel, John says something about setting out on our own. Here in this closing chapter of his Gospel, we find John reminding us that to accept the call of Jesus is to recognize things change. And once involved, the things that we go back to will have nothing really for us. We are to trust him as we move forward. Trust him to work in us and through us. But there's something else here as well, because this second story John chooses to show is breakfast on the beach. Jesus reaches out to the disciples. He has a fire burning with bread baking, and he says, bring some of the fish. We'll share breakfast together. There's something significant about eating together, particularly breaking bread together. I don't think it's any accident that John and Luke both end their Gospels with a story where Jesus breaks bread or shares bread with his disciples. Throughout the history of the church, the sharing of meals has been an important part of building community, creating a sense of belonging. One of the strengths of the early church was that they met together in their homes and they broke bread together regularly. One of the strengths of the monasteries in the Middle Ages was they always welcomed a traveler with accommodation and with food. It's why we encourage you to stay after church and enjoy a cup of tea and coffee and to chat with us. It's why when you're online, we encourage you to stay and to chat with those others who are online, and which is why afterwards I always say to you, if you feel able, come and chat to the people who are online. They're part of this community. It's why we encourage people to join home groups, and it's about building community. And I know that on a Sunday, because we have both an in-person and an online community, sharing a meal together or even sharing tea and coffee doesn't really work anymore, not in the way it used to be able to. And I wonder how we'll find another way that encourages each of us to believe and understand that we belong to what part of this community. But there's more to sharing a meal than simply building a community. There's something missional about sharing a meal together, because there's nothing more easy to do over a meal than to share a story, to share something of ourselves, something of our experience, and share something, particularly in a church context, of our experience of Jesus. It's why a meal is such an important part of the Alpha course. Once again, it's why monastic communities always have a refectory where you can share meals with the monks or the nuns as they go about their regular routine of prayer and work and study and worship. A rhythm centered around a desire to follow Jesus. Sharing meals help build community. They help provide opportunities for mission in a relaxed and easy way. But there's more to this breakfast on the beach in John's Gospel than simply building community or offering hospitality, sharing stories. There's something in this meal that Jesus shares with his disciples that is restorative, which brings us to this table. Because there's something about sharing this meal, this tiny package of juice and a wafer. A meal that, depending on your tradition, you might call the Mass or the Eucharist or Holy Communion, the Lord's Supper or breaking of bread. Here in a simple meal together, we find restoration. We speak often of this table being a place where mercy and hope and grace are found. We speak of a place where the unearned blessing of God, the undeserved love of God, are encountered as we remember the blood and the body broken and the blood shed for us in Jesus. And we will do so again in a moment. And while there's no act of confession in the disciples sharing a meal with Jesus, there is something in Jesus offering himself, offering bread and fish, that is about restoration. Here in the simple act of preparing breakfast for them, Jesus engages them in an act of restoration. He takes the act a stage further when he says to Peter, come and walk with me. Well, John doesn't record that, but he just records them walking on the beach and having a conversation. Now, if there's one person who has failed Jesus utterly and completely, it is Peter. It is Peter who had said to Jesus in the upper room, the others might desert you. I will never leave you. And yet it was Peter who was pressed, when pressed, denied he knew or was associated with Jesus on three occasions. Following the resurrection, it was Peter who struggled to believe the first reports of the resurrection. He had to go and see for himself, and even then he was left wondering what had happened. It was Peter, having encountered the risen Jesus on two occasions, said, I'm going fishing. If there's one person that had let Jesus down completely, it was Peter, and yet there's one person who's looking for restoration. It's Peter. As soon as he hears it's the Lord on the shore, he's the first one to put on his clothes, to jump in the water and to run and greet him. His response of putting on his clothes and jumping in the water raises a question for us. It says, are you looking for restoration? Because it's clear from the way John shapes the ending of his gospel, the desire for restoration is not a question for Jesus, it's a question for us. It's our question. The desire to be restored in our relationship with Jesus is one that Jesus easily responds to. He's more than willing to restore us. And thus, the one person who failed him completely is taken for a walk and asked three times, do you love me? Each time, when Peter responds positively, Jesus restores him a little bit more. Three times, Jesus commissions him. Scholars make a lot of this point, of this three times that Peter denied Jesus in the courtyard, and three times he is restored by Jesus. But there's something here in this threefold restoration, something again of a completeness, a recommissioning completely, a setting aside of all that's gone before, setting aside of his denial in the courtyard, his doubting over the resurrection, is saying, I'm going fishing. This threefold complete restoration begins with a miraculous catch of fish, continues over breakfast, and the completeness of the failure is evident in this passage, but so is the completeness of the restoration. Ask the question for us, where as individuals, as a church, have we slipped back into our old ways? And where would Jesus bring us back? It asks the questions when we come to this table, where do we need to be restored? And it reminds us that in a simple meal of bread and cup, wafer and juice, Jesus is able to restore and restore completely. I wonder, as we come to this table, whether we will seek that restoration. Amen.